Okay. So if you remember, we saw that in addition to the principled positions about why electricity might be usher, Rav Yaakov Ariel argued that he thinks that really, it's a violation of the Ramban Shabbaton. Meaning, if you consistently violate things that are against the spirit of Shabbat, then you cross over into the biblical area of Shabbaton because you've transformed Shabbat into a weekday. And he argues that even though that might be the case, and even though maybe Meikradin we follow Rishon Zalman Orbach, he thinks that there's a value to sort of muddling through a little bit and treating it as if it's biblical, because we're worried that if we don't treat it as biblical, then people won't take it seriously, and that will really destroy Shabbat. And we saw that the Chazon Ish's student went even farther. The Chazon Ish's student said that when he had a conversation with the Chazon Ish about a lenient article on electricity printed by Goran, he asked him, like, what are you so angry about? Like, you know, you have machlokot all the time. So, you know, so he thinks it's more mutter than you do, and you think it's usher. What's the problem? And the Chazon Ish said, you don't understand. Sometimes there are things where it's probably mutter. You gotta, you know, it's probably usher, and you need to find a hit there, right, if you want to be mutter it. But by electricity, it's the opposite. It's very hard to figure out why it should be forbidden. But I want it to be forbidden, right? So once he found a smach that it was forbidden, he said, it could be bona, so he hung his hat on it. But it wasn't even, like, totally clear he believed it. That was what a student argued. Now, that's not quite lying. Neither of those are quite lying, right? Meaning they're, both of them are saying, you know, according to the Chazon Ish's students, like, he wasn't convinced by it, but he wasn't not convinced by it, but he was very much motivated to paskin that it was usher, so he's willing to sort of go with a less likely position.
Sorry, other sources are flying away.
So he's willing to go with a less likely position to convince people that it was usher. And according to Rav Yaakov Ariel, there's a, you know, there's a benefit to treating it as if it's d'oraisa, but it's not really. Now, this is a little bit of a dangerous, it's a little bit of a dangerous area, because it really forces us to ask the question, like, let's say you have a, you do feel that fundamentally that something is probably mutter, but it would be really bad if you said it was mutter. Right? Or you think it's only derabanan, but you think it would really be bad if people thought it was just derabanan. Or you think it's the spirit of Shabbos, but you know that people don't take the spirit of Shabbos seriously. So you really, really think that it should be problematic. But if you say what you think, you're afraid people won't listen to you. Right? And as we saw, in electricity, that seems to be a lot of what's going on. Right? Again, I'm not saying the Chazon Ish is quite there. He's not quite there, even according to his student. Right? He's saying, I'm not convinced it's bonehead, but I'm willing to interpret it that way. And, you know, Rav Yaakov Ariel is not lying. He's saying, I think fundamentally it's mutter, but we should treat it as usher. It's not quite the same as saying, I'm going to pretend that it's usher, right? Like, I'm going to tell people it's usher when it's not. It's, I think we should treat it as usher. But sometimes people go just half a step more, and they really don't believe that it's usher, but they're willing to say it's usher in order to get people to do the right thing. In electricity, sometimes you feel like, at least you got to understand, is that a legitimate thing to do? Because there are definitely people who might be somewhere in that range. So is that an okay way of writing? Right now that we're going to move towards writing, is that okay? Right? Is it legitimate to say, you know, because let's say you think it's a bad idea, or it's against the spirit of Shabbos. So there's two ways you could deal with that. You could either say, I think it is usher, when what you mean is, I think it's not in the spirit of Shabbos, I think it's a bad idea, but people aren't going to listen to me, so I'll say it's usher. Is that legitimate? Or do you have to say, I think it's just against the spirit of Shabbos, which I know most people don't take seriously, but I really think you should take it seriously, and this is why. Knowing that you might lose people there. Right? Or in other words, right, can you bend the truth to try to get people to be more serious? Right? Meaning you have an idea of what the result should be, but not necessarily for the reason that you're saying. Is that legitimate? So there's really, you know, this is really the line between halakha and policy. And it really cuts to the heart of the question of how we think about policy decisions, and specifically, especially if, let's say, you have an idea sort of like Rabbi Yaakov Ariel, right? Rabbi Yaakov Ariel, again, thinks that if you performed a non-Shabbistic action once, so, you know, maybe it's Derabbanan, but if you do it all the time, it's Deraisa. But we should treat it as usur so that you don't even do it once because you might end up doing it a lot. Right? That's like classic slippery slope policy, right? Meaning, doing it once is not such a big deal, but I know that if I tell you to do it once, you'll end up doing a lot, and that I think really is a big deal. So how do we make decisions like that? Now, this idea of, you know, making policies based on slippery slope, or, right, this is two things. One, there's really two things that you have to ask. One is it legitimate to forbid something on policy grounds because of the slippery slope? That's one. Two is it legitimate? As soon as I say it, I'm going to ask to make sure this is clear because it's very, right, this is a very important distinction. One question, again, is it legitimate to forbid something on policy grounds because you're concerned of the slippery slope? Question one. Question two, is it legitimate to pretend that something is actually forbidden when what you're really concerned about is the slippery slope? Okay? Right? Those are two questions, right? One is, you acknowledge its policy, right? Meaning you say, I don't think this is intrinsically problematic, but I think it could lead to something problematic. Is that legitimate? Right? That's a slippery slope argument, right? Right? I just gave you, right, Wikipedia, but slippery slope argument, there's good slippery slope arguments and bad ones. Slippery slope arguments is, if you do minor act X, you will definitely do Y. That's an illegitimate slippery slope argument. A legitimate one is, because I'm worried about Y, I would prefer you not to do X. I'm not saying it'll necessarily lead to Y, I'm just saying that Y is so bad that it's worth forbidding X to make sure that you don't end up at Y. So, again, the two questions you have to ask are, one, is it legitimate to, on policy grounds, forbid something which intrinsically is not problematic but could lead to something problematic? And question two is it legitimate to frame a policy as law? Right?
Yeah.
Yeah? Those are two very different things. Okay? So what do you think about the first one? Is it legitimate to establish that something is forbidden on policy grounds? Yeah, I mean, that's literally what all of rabbinic law is, right? Rabbinic law is that. That's what a siyag is. Before we get to lectures, let's talk generally, right? Question one, is it legitimate to, because of concerns of what might happen, to forbid something in advance, right, on policy grounds? The answer is, of course, meaning that's what rabbinic law is. Right? Rabbinic law, I gave you just the first mission in Avot, is Asu Siag LaTorah. That is the third thing that the Chachamim say in the first mission in Avot. Right? The Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, their third thing they say is make safeguards for the Torah. Right? Like that, that is literally that's like the basis of Rabbinic Judaism, is the legitimacy of setting up arguments like that. Elsewhere, if you look in the Gemara in Moed Katan, you can tell this is a very old source. They don't have spaces, they don't have numbers, whatever. But elsewhere in the Gemara derives this from Rav Ashi, who shmartim et mishmarti, asu mishmart mishmarti, playing on a pasuk by Truma, we say that you can, you should set up a safeguard for my Torah. Now, admittedly, the Gemara in Yevamot in Daf Chof Aleph says that this is only an asmachta, this source is only an asmachta, but okay. It's definitely clear that Chazal viewed this notion that we should set things up to protect the Torah. That's ABCs, right? Another common source quoted, what you have here in Bamidbar Rabbah, is we derive it from Nazir, that the Torah derives, that even the Torah itself told the Nazir to avoid grapes, even though what it meant was wine. So the way that in the Midrashic mind, that's actually the Torah protecting itself. The Torah itself made a siyag to its words. Because we tell the Nazir, listen, go away, avoid the wine, avoid the winery, the vineyard, because we don't want him to violate. So the notion that you can set up safeguards is, right, this is like ABCs of Rabbinic Judaism. And it's not just Talmud, right, it's not just Chazal. It's pretty much a given that assuming you can get people to listen to you, it's legitimate to do this in every generation. So if you turn to the second page, for example, look at the Magen Avot. It appears in other Mepharshim, but it's very clear in the Magen Avot. If you look at the Magen Avot of the Rashba, the Avot says, there's a bolded part on the top of the second page, every generation can set these decrees up, and we know that. Right? Anyone who says, we can't set up takanot, they're wrong. Of course we can set up takanot. We have takanot. Right? We have takanot which are post-Talmudic. Right? Right? People don't, right? They don't marry multiple wives. That's cherem derein gershom. That's post-Talmudic. But everyone treats it as law. Right? With the possible exception of certain Sephardi poskim who felt that it wasn't binding in the context of Yibum. But even that is, right, has fallen out of practice in the last 50 years. Right, even in the last vestiges of the communities that did that. People are under the impression that people aren't allowed nowadays to set up a takana because we're not chazal. That's not right. The reason we can't set up a takana is because no one will listen to you. The only thing you need to make a takana binding is the consensus of the people that they'll listen to you. If they won't listen to you, then it won't work. But if they would listen to you, so then what's wrong with it? Okay, the Magen Avot says, if we didn't have these, the Torah would collapse little by little. Like Chazal say, a vineyard is not like a vineyard which is not protected. And the Rambam also, right? The Rambam even includes this in Lok Tasur. If you look at the next source, the Rambam says that even the minhagim and the gzeir and the kanot of every generation is included in Lo Tasur, like the same pasuk from which rabbinic power comes. Even minhagim are included in Lo Tasur. And the same is true, mayhem minhagot, the customs, vatakanot, the decrees, shehet kino shenagu bechol dor vador, kimosher obeit and shalot odor. Any generation who does this, it's binding under Lo Tasur. So the fact that we recognize, in general, the legitimacy of takanot, that I think is a given. Now, that may be a practical problem with electricity, which is that we're living in a world where there isn't a centralized rabbinic authority, and therefore it's unlikely that you get anyone to accept it. But let's say we could get all of Klal Yisrael to accept that we should forbid, say we fundamentally agree with the Shlomo Zalman that it's permitted to use electricity on Shabbos, but we all agree it's a bad idea, so let's, as a group, set up a takana, right? If all of Klal Yisrael would do that, so I don't think anyone would say that's illegitimate. You're just not going to get there, which is why that's not really what we're talking about. Okay. I think that for our purposes, the much bigger question is, okay, what about fudging the lines between law and policy because you're not sure it's forbidden, but you want it to be forbidden, and you know you don't have the ability to get everyone together to agree to make a policy decision, so you fudge the lines, which again is not, which is almost what Rav Yaakov Ariel says is the minhag of electricity, right? Which is, it's probably just Dirabanan, only Daraisa did it all the time, but we treat each individual act as if it's Daraisa so that we don't get to that point, right? It's not quite fudge. It's not quite lying. It's fudging, right? Or the student of the Chazon Eish is even closer to fudging, right? Which is, he really didn't mean it was bone. He just sort of thought that was maybe plausible, so hung his hat on it. But he really just thought it had to be usher, right? But let's just say that you have a posek who isn't convinced that it's usher, but thinks it should be usher, okay? So I'm not going to attribute this to the Chazon Eish or Rav Yaakov Ariel, but let's say you think it is forbidden. It should be forbidden, but it isn't forbidden, okay? Let's just, theoretical, you think it's like Rav Shlomo Zalman, and electricity is not really usur, but you think it really should be usur, right? It really should be problematic, right? We should treat it as usur. But you know that if you say that, no one will listen to you. But if you say, what do you mean? We pass on the Chazon Eish, we pass on the Beis Yitzchak, we pass on like whoever, then you'll get the same result. But you'll be presenting what you think is policy as law. Is that legitimate? That's a much more difficult. Ah, good. Okay, so here's the thing. So this is actually a very complicated, yeah.
When you first asked the question, though, I thought you were getting something more along the lines of, like, not putting forth, like, hey, I think this sheet got someone else is the right one, but saying, like, your own opinion, like coming up with, like, faulty,
oh, you could do that too. I mean, look, you're right. I think it's more egregious to come up with a faulty halachic reason. But let's say you were, look, there's gradations here, right? Because you could say, look, I'm not convinced it's usher, but if someone asks me if it's usher, I'll say, well, look, I'm not convinced that it's usher, but all the Gedolim think it's usher for one reason and the other, so on balance, I think we have to treat it as usher, right? That is different, because there, you could say that with integrity, even if you're not convinced, right? You could say, right, that's fine. That, I think, is fine, right? And a lot of the posts can sort of say this, which is, right, like, a Rusher wise really thinks it's usher. But before he gets to that point, he says, and everyone says it's usher for one reason or another, so it didn't have a boss call came from heaven and said it was usher. I think if someone said, look, I'm not sure why it's usher, but everyone says it's usher, so I really do think we have to treat it as usher. Right, that's legitimate. That's not what I'm talking about. That's an honest, that's basically saying, look, this is the weight of halachic authority that it's usher. I'm not sure why, but it is. Right? But then you could have someone who either says, I'm convinced that all these positions are wrong, but I'm going to go with the flow, not because I think that's the right thing to do on halachic grounds. Right? Right? This is a very nuanced difference. Right? Someone might say, look, on halachic grounds, I think if the majority says something to us, or whether or not I understand why, I think we have to follow it. Because then you really think on legal grounds you should follow them. You don't know the rationale, but you think that's the right thing to do, legally. But then if you someone who says, no, I think there's all a mistake, halachically, but I think it's right politically, so I'm going to go along with it. Right? Or even worse is to come up with a halachic reason that you don't believe in, or put your name forcefully behind a reason you don't believe in, just to ensure that the consequences are that people treat it as usher. That's much more dangerous ground, right? Yeah.
So another thing is, what if you think that electricity is, like, from a melacha standpoint, is completely usher, but then you would say that, like, for Shabbat phone, it would be usher. But no one's actually going to follow you if you say Shabbat phone. Like, even if you might think it's usher, but you would like a different...
Right, but that's another variation. I'm saying, I think it's usher if you do it all the time, but no one's going to listen, so I'll say if you do it once, it's usher. Right? I mean, that's what Yaakov Ariel says we're basically doing, is that we really think it's usher because of Shabbaton, but we say that it's usher ki'ilu, it's bone, or ki'ilu, it's molid, on a single act to make sure that people don't do it all the time. Right? Again, he's honest about it, because he actually writes it that way in his Shuvah, but right, you can imagine someone believing that in his mind and not being open about it.
Yeah.
Right? For that reason, is that, and that's the type of thing that I want to talk about. So, is that okay? So, let me go a little bit backwards here. The Rambam has a very strong opinion about this. And the Rambam says, not only is that not okay, it's also going to be d'oraisa. That is a biblical isser. What is the biblical isser? So you look at the second to last source on this second page. The Rambam says as follows. Ho'il v'yesh l'beit din l'gzor v'lasar davar mutar v'amod yisro l'darot v'chein yesh l'atir yisurei torah l'fishah Moses is here torah l'otisa v'lo l'zikra v'menu. If the rabbis have the right to set up rabbinic law, then what is the prohibition of the Torah of don't add to the Torah? If you're allowed to add to the Torah, then what does it mean you're not allowed to add to the Torah? So the Rambam says, Shlohosiv lo devei Torah lo legrami men, umayen, ulukvoa davar lo olam, badar shum na Torah, bein betarah, shivakta, bein shudar bal peh. So ketan. So how does it go? He said, this is what it means. Hare katuv betarah l'savashel gadei v'chalei v'imam. The Torah says, don't cook a mother, a goat in its mother's milk. We understand this biblically to forbid all meat and milk, bein basar behemah, bein basar chaya. I will basar ha'of, but biblically, poultry, chicken, whatever, is mutar and milk. Mutar v'chalav on a Torah. So in yavo beitin v'yatir basar chaya v'chalav hareza goreya. If a beitin would come and say that meat in milk is permitted, that would be goreya. That would be removing the Torah. V'im yasur basar ha'of. But if they were to forbid chicken and milk, v'yomar shu b'chlal ha'gadiv, v'asur men ha'Torah, and they would say it's forbidden biblically, hareza mosif. So then it would be forbidden biblically. Aval im amar basar ha'of mutar men ha'Torah, v'anen na'asar oto v'nodiyah lam shikzeirah. But if we say it's asur rabbinically, and we forbade it on policy grounds, and made it a rabbinic prohibition, we don't lead to a violation of biblical law. Right, so we don't lead to the problem. So then he says it's totally mutter. Right, so the Rambam's position is as follows. If you acknowledge that a rabbinic law is only rabbinic law, then you are fully within your rights to protect the Torah. But if you pretend that a rabbinic law is biblical, in order to protect the biblical law itself, then you're violating a biblical law of Baltosif. Right? So the Rambam, at least in the context of Chazal, and we'll come to whether this tells us anything about modern-day Pesach, but at least in the context of Chazal, the Rambam believes that pretending that something which is forbidden on rabbinic grounds is biblical is the prohibition of baltosis. So it's legitimate to forbid something rabbinically on policy grounds as long as you acknowledge that that's what you're doing. But if you don't, so then you're trying to add to the corpus of the Torah, and that is a problem. Okay? Yeah? Clear? Now, the truth is that according to Avot Rabbi Natan, this might actually be the original sin. Now, you'll tell me, really, this is the original sin? Isn't the original sin, you know, eating the fruit of the tree? No. According to Avot Rabbi Natan, the original sin was actually this. Yes, exactly. So if you look at Avot Rabbi Natan, this is in the middle of the second page, Ezu siyag sha'asa, what is the first siyag? Sha'asa adam arishon lidvarav. Adam arishon made a guard around his words. Why? Hare you omer ma'itav Hashem Elokim al adam lemor mikol eitagan achol tochel. Umeitadat ovara lo tocham imenu. K'biyom achocham imenu motamud. God had said, don't eat from the tree. Lo rez adam arishon lomar l'chava keder ha'shamar l'yakadosh baruch hu. But Adam didn't want to tell Chava the truth, because he thought that if he told her not to eat, she might accidentally end up eating. So what did he do? Elokach omar la, umipri ha'itz asher b'tocha gan, amar Elohim, lo tochlu mimenu, lo tigu bo pentimudun. So he told her, you can't touch the tree. But ota sha'a hayam nachash ha'rasha notel eitza b'libo. And that gave the snake his good idea. Amar ho v'eni yachol la'achshil ad Adam. He said, look, I can't mess up Adam. Elech v'achshil ad Chava, so I'll mess up Chava. Halach v'yashav imo. So he went, he started talking to Chava. Amar lo, and he said, in you think God told you not to touch it? Harino gebo, look, I'm touching it, nothing's happening. Atmeta. He Atmeta. So if you touch it, nothing will happen either. Masa Nachasha Rasha. What did he do? Both of Shah. Amad Nagavi Lambia Davraglav here too. Ashadarshu Berdav. Laaret. So he did that. He just kept touching it until he convinced her that. that it was really not a problem at all. Similarly, in Breishit Rabba, it says this as well, and it said that if you make the Geder more than the Ikar, you will end up being a heretic. Proof, Chava. So what do you see here? So on the one hand, right, you could just look at this Avot Rabbi Natan and say at some level this is the rabbis being self-aware of the dangers of rabbinic decrees. But I would argue that, and this is really, reverse goes in this direction as well, is that the message of this Midrash is, like the Rambam, is that when you blur the line between policy and law, so then you lead to problems, because then people violate the policy, violate the dirabanan, and they don't see the consequences because you've treated it as if this is the intrinsic problem, but it's not, right? And then once you pretend that the dirabanan is the real problem, they stop taking you seriously. And that might be part of what the problem is with pretending the dirabanan is d'oraisa. Now, Rav Henkin has a whole piece on this in his in Equality Lost about how, right, for him, the original sin was man not treating woman as his equal and thinking that he couldn't trust her with divine command, right? And he builds a whole fascinating sort of theological point, right, on what the original sin actually was in the mind of this Midrash. But that's sort of it's an interesting article. It's worth reading. So at least when it comes to the original Dirabanans, what you get from the Rambam is that you're allowed to ban things on policy grounds as long as you acknowledge what you're doing. Otherwise, it just, A, it's forbidden, and B, it's bad advice, because it will lead people to misunderstand what you're doing and end up just devaluing the whole system. On the other hand, if you look at the last source in page 2, you have this shocking piece in the Maharil. Maharil, who's one of the most important sources for Ashkenazi, Minhag, and Psak, says the following. What is an asmachta? What's an asmachta? What do you know about asmachta? We'll see. So most Rishonim understood that an asmachta is a rabbinic law that we attach to a pasuk for memory reasons, for aesthetic reasons, but it's totally derabanan. But the Maharil has this shocking position that an asmachta is a derabanan that we pretend is d'oraisa to make sure that no one violates it. Right? We attach it to a pasuk in order to trick people into keeping it. So he writes, Kol heicha de'idma midirabananu across asmachta ba'alma. Whenever we say something is really derabanan and the pasuk is an asmachta, ha'chei perusha. This is what it means. Vaday dekan de derabanan hu. Vehem yatsu batku umatsu lahem smach mikra. And they found the support from a pasuk. V'samchu devrayim alav kidei lahachzikam. And then they supported it with a pasuk to strengthen it. She used svurim to whom the daraita v'yachmiru bo. So that people would think it was daraita and be strict, and not come to be lenient in the words of the Chachamim. Now that's really a shocking position, right? Because the Maharil is the opposite of the Rambam, right? The Rambam says that Chazal were allowed to set policy decisions as long as they made it clear what it was, and called the Derabanan Derabanan. Otherwise, it's falsosim. Otherwise, according to Avodah Rabbi Natan, it undermines faith in the system. The Maharil says, no, it's the opposite. You're supposed to pretend that a darabanan is a daraisa in order to make sure that people keep it. Right? And that's what a smacha is.
Doesn't that just mean there's like a failure of our educational...
Oh, so there are so many problems. Right? So there are so many problems with this. So let me... If you want, I can send you this other thing I have, which is like makaras I've collected since I gave this share for myself. But let me read you a footnote from an article by Rabbi Dovin Aryeh Frimher on this. It's just a footnote. They write very lengthy footnotes, and then this is just me sort of putting their makarot just in that footnote in a 15-page packet for myself. It's a very extensive footnote, but let me read it, okay? I'll send it to you. Meaning I didn't put it on this sheet. It's on their. I think this is their women's Tefillah group article online. But it's footnote or appendix 5, ruling that something is biblically forbidden when it is not may violate Baal Tosef. So here's how it goes. As mentioned in note 227, it's a long article. All their articles have very long footnotes and very extensive footnotes. What? I remember when I read their article on partnership in Yanim, and like, you know, I told people, like, don't talk to me until I finish it. So I read through it twice with every footnote. And then I'm like, okay, now we can talk. But like, I really have read every footnote. I really don't want to talk to you unless you've read every footnote. Because like, you know, how do you know that you haven't missed something they said? They have like 400 footnotes. And like, each of them has like 500 sources. It was a very intense article. I checked out sources where I thought they were salient, like it was salient for the argument. I tried to check them out. This was a long time ago. It came out when I was in yeshiva. They write, as mentioned in note 227 based in Baal Tosef, Maimonides forbids claiming that something is biblically forbidden when it's actually rabbinic in origin. In Hilchot Mamrim 2:9, he writes, if the court forbids fowl, yeast and milk, claiming that it is included in goat and is forbidden biblically, this is an addition. However, if it is said that goat flesh is biblically permitted, but we forbid it and we notify the people that it is a rabbinic edict, this is not an addition. Rivet dissents, arguing that biblical verses often cited in the Talmud as source text for rabbinic prohibitions. I'm skipping down a little here. Now, Rav Henkin, now, here's where I want to move it. This is about Chazal, but what about a later posek? What do you think? What about a later posek? For a later posek, is it the same or not? Right? And we've seen that according to the Rambam, Chazal can't pretend that something is Derabana is Doraisa. And Maril seems to think that's what Asmachta is. What would you say about a later posek? Can a later posek pretend that something is law when it's policy? Right? Which would be the modern equivalent. What? Okay. So, let's see. So Rav Henkin suggests, and this is in if you want to look it up, it's in Bein Banim Chelek Aleph Tshuva Lamed Zayin Section 12. It's his very long article about mixed dancing. Very, very long article about mixed dancing. No, it's not that long, but it's long. It's a long Hebrew tshuva, but Bnei Banim has now all been uploaded. It was always on Hebrew books, but now it's all been uploaded to Sfaria, so you can get it in text form. So he argues that the Rambam would say this is only true for the Sanhedrin. Only the Sanhedrin, who have the power to create real law, are forbidden to pretend that their law is Doraisa, because then it's going to be Baal Tosef. Right? Because only if you have the power to create law is your pretending that your law is biblical going to be adding to the corpus of Torah. But if you're a posek and you're not the Sanhedrin, you don't have that power anyways. You're just poskening. It's not that it doesn't matter, but that it's not Baal Tosef. It's not technically Baal Tosef, because...
He can't do
Baal Tosef. Exactly. Since he doesn't have the capability to do Baal Tosef, One second. Now, most people disagree. Okay? Most disagree. The Chinuch is explicit that this applies to future, to other poskim as well. I'll read you the language of the Chinuch. The Chinuch writes, "Shinamna'enu shelo nosef v'ter shebachtav lo tzar shebal peh." You can't add to the written or oral or Torah. Then he quotes the Rambam. He seems to be very explicit. This is true, right? About any Moreh. Right, yeah. He quotes the Rambam as Hamoreh. Right? Not the Bezdin, but any Moreh, any Posek. Now, Rav Hengen tries to defend himself. They say that this is in personal communication. So I've no written, this is my source for Rav Hengen saying this. Rav Hengen apparently argues that the reason the Chinuch holds that it's true of all Posekim is because the Chinuch, like the Ritva, uniquely holds that any Posek holds the power of Lotasar. Right? That listening to your own authority is under the auspices of the mitzvah del reis of Lotasur, and therefore you are, if you have the power of Lotasur, you have the power you have to run the risk of Baltosis. However, and I tend to think that the Frimmers, the rabbis, doctors, whatever, I cannot do this, rabbis, doctors, Frimmer, okay, however, they're very, very smart people. One is, I forget, one is a lawyer, one is a doctor, scientist, chemist, I think. I forget. Something like that. They're very, very smart. And I think they're both rabbis, doctor. They know that most folks can disagree. And they know that if you look in the Sefer Kiryat Sefer, they paraphrase the Rambam using the singular, meaning any posek. Similarly, Rabbi Yaakov Ibn Forno in the Birkei Yosef, Maritz Chiyot, Reb Chaim is quoted in Nefesh HaRav this way, as taking it as a given that any posek would be forbidden from doing this. Right? Any posek pretending that something is biblical when it's not would violate this. Reb Chaim has a slightly different formulation. It's not just saying it's Daraisa, but it's treating it with the Chumrah of Daraisa. That makes it that way, right? Like, if you treat something Daraisa the Chumrah, right, you treat what's not Daraisa Daraisa, that's the same problem. And they know, Ramban seems to say this as well. And they argue that, on balance, the majority of poskim assume that that this is true even for later poskim. And based on this, the Maariv Chiyus challenges a position of the Chasam Sofer that we'll look at in just a minute. Okay? So the majority of poskim, they argue, don't agree with this. They think that even for a later posek, to mix law and policy in this way, definitely they're pretending with Doraisa, is in Baltosif. Okay? Now, I will note that Rav Hengen doesn't necessarily think it's a good idea. He just might think it, he just says it's not a technical violation of Baltosif. He's also not in favor of this. He just doesn't think it's technically Baltosif.
But I have a problem with Rav Hengen's thing.
Oh, yes.
Okay, because people are not, like, the average person who's asking for stock or whatever is not going to know necessarily, like, they might not realize if this is, like, the right or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, look, Rav Hengen is taking a highly formalist view here, which I think, as I tend to agree here with Rabbi's Frimmer, that, I'm just going to say that, I can't keep doing Rabbi's doctors, it's I tend to agree with them, right, that on balance, I think, it's probably true of later generations also. Because it's not just about, like, the formal thing of, like, creating a new chalos of Torah, like, there's a certain sensibility about Pesach that's being portrayed by the Rambam. But this is a very big machloket. So the way I like teaching this, and I won't read it all inside for you, but I gave you several pages of it. There's one of my professors in YU, Deborah Kaplan, claims that this is the best article ever written in Jewish studies. I mean, she's a little bit biased because it's early modern Jewish history, and that's her field. But it's definitely one of the most important articles I've ever read in my entire life on early modern, in halachic history, for sure, which is Michael Silber's article, The Emergence of Ultra-Orthodoxy, The Invention of a Tradition, which is basically the history of the creation of Haredi Judaism in 19th century Hungary. But one of the things that he really plays on was the Beit Midrash of the Chassam Sofer leading up to the Pesach Din of Michalav Shaf, which I can never pronounce correctly, but it's on this next page, right? M-I-C-H-A-L-O-W-C-E, Michalav Shaf. I'm just going to go with that. So, the Chassam Sofer, if you just turn right past the English article for a second, just look at one line of Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer says, V'ha'omnam babonotenu harabim hador parut tipika. In our sins, our nation is parut, right? They are free-thinking. V'ra'ui l'gdor geder v'lasut siag l'ator l'achmir v'losiv kula. You should always look for chumrot. Always look for chumrot. And in several places, he goes farther, and he says that even when something is only a minhag, you should find a way to portray it as d'oraisa. And that, he thought, was one of his strategies to defend against reform, because they were starting by knocking at minhagim and d'rabbanans. So come up with a way of explaining that everything's d'oraisa, which he did. He basically said that any minhag is under neder, and neder is d'oraisa. This came to a fore in the Pesachdin of Michalav Shaf. So what happened? So in 1865, there was a massive machlokas, not between the Haredim and the Reformers, but between the Haredim and the Neo-Orthodox, or the German Orthodox, essentially, right? Well, the progenitors of modern Orthodoxy, but then it was called Neo, we call it Neo-Orthodoxy, okay? Meaning the world of Rav Hirsch, of Rav Hildesheimer, of, you know, Rav Zvi Hoffman, all those people. What were their machlokas? So, there were basically two approaches to responding to reform. There was the approach of the Chassam Sofer, which was buckle down, say chadash asr min ha-Torah, and fight every change tooth and nail. And then there was the approach of German Jewry, which was fight for what's important, and the things that are legitimate to change, change. Right? So German Jewry said, there's no reason we can't change to modern clothes. Why not? And they did. And because of that, they were given a derisive, right, a derogatory nickname. What's the derogatory nickname? People don't even realize it's derogatory anymore. What's the derogatory nickname that was given to German Jewry because of it? What? Yekka, right? They're Yek, right? A Yekka, right? Yek. Why are German Jews called Yekim? It means jacket. Because they wore short jackets as opposed to the long kafatas.
No,
it's internal Jewish.
Okay.
Right, it's internal Jewish. Because another thing they changed was that they spoke in the vernacular. They gave the drush in the vernacular. Right? And this was controversial. It was controversial into the 20th century. There's a amazing tshuva that I came across once from Leo Young to the Sridi Eish. You know Leo Young?
Yeah.
No. No?
Yeah.
What? Okay, so Leo Young, basically in mid-20th century New York, there were like three super pulpit rabbis. Like, you know how like there's always like the pulpit rabbis that everybody knows, right? Like, I don't know who the modern equivalent is. You know, not quite like Rabbi Sacks, not like chief rabbi, but like the one that everybody knows, you know, whatever it would be. What? Whatever it might be, I don't know. Meaning, like the pulpit rabbis that all other pulpit rabbis want to be like, that they get advice from, like those people, right? Like Rabbi Lookstein, right? Think about like Rabbi Lookstein on the Upper East Side, okay? Right, like the pulpit, like think of like, you know, like Rabbi Lookstein, right? Like he's the pulpit rabbi that like speaks at the White House, right? Like, you know, that type of. Right, like that type of pulpit rabbi, or whatever, like the legendary pulpit rabbis, okay? Whatever. So there were three on the in Manhattan who were like really, really well known in the mid-20th century. They were like the rabbis, right? One of them was Rabbi Leo Young, who was at the Jewish Center, okay? I remember once in Gush, I was looking for like an obscure Sefer, and, you know, the Gush Library has like whatever, $100,000, so you can find whatever you want. But I opened it up, and it was from the private library of Leo Young, right? Because his daughter, who lives in Long Shore, had donated his library after he passed away to the Gush Library. So he wrote a letter to the Sri Deish about this, and he said, look, I want to change to speak in English as opposed to Yiddish. And the Sri Deish wrote back to him, look, obviously it's halachically mutter, but why do you want to do that to yourself? Like, why would you do that to yourself? Right, like it was apparently controversial still in like mid-20th century America. I think in the Jewish Center it was in English. I don't know if it was the beginning of the Jewish Center or before, I don't remember what it was. There were similar little machlokot over machine matzah, which became a huge fight, right? Machine matzah was like, you know, the end of the world, and they wrote like, you know how many books that were written about, you know, keeping the covenant alive? I mean, it became... So what happened? So two very, 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 very kanoish talmidim of the Chasam Sofer, rabbis Hillel Lichtenstein and Akiva Schlesinger, decided they were going to get together a group of rabbis and paskin that all these things, speaking the vernacular, wearing the was Aser mid'oraisa. And they came up with very creative arguments, like Midrashim, about how in Mitzrayim they didn't change their language, and they didn't, right? That became like the Midrash that they built their whole life on, right? That the Jews in Mitzrayim didn't change their language, and they didn't change their clothes, and that became, and therefore, if you do, it's v'chukotem lo teilecho, it's following the non-Jews, it's Aser mid'oraisa, it's Kein Avodah Zarah, and they paskined in a psak in 1865, the psak din of Michalovtcha.
Actually, wait, I'm thinking, is he Polish?
What?
Is he Polish?
He's Hungarian.
Okay, I'm pretty sure the L is pronounced like a W. Like,
oh,
what? It's like,
sounds
like a
F.
Which one?
Like, Lechvoinsa
is pronounced
like W, but
like the...
What? Michalowa
Kabe.
Mika, like... Lavwa, Mika...
Yeah.
Something like that. Lau, whatever. Anyways. It was so extreme. It was so extreme that some of the other Talmidim of the Chasam Sofer, who were known to be zealots, like the Maram Shik, he was also known as a Kanoi. Right, he was like the prime Talmud of the Chasam Sofer, who was already known as like the extreme postake of Hungary, right? Wrote to them and said, what you are doing is violating the Isser Daraita of the Rambam of Baal Tosif, because I agree with you, you shouldn't be speaking the vernacular, but it is not Aser mid'oraisa, and by writing this, you are violating Baal Tosif, right? I there's one thing, I had this amazing moment, though, where this was one of the first shiurim I gave in Toronto, because it was the first week I was there, they asked me to give the Pirkei Avos shiur in shul, which is like a very big deal in the bias. It's because right, Karofkin's shiur, it's like the rabbi's shiur, but like to introduce me to the community, and it's right before Mincha, so on the summer Shabbos, you know, in Toronto, where Shabbos ends at like 10:30, whatever it is, 10:15, 10:30, so like, Mincha is already like 8:30, so like to come to a half-hour shiur before Mincha, like everyone is dying for things to do by that point. So it's a very big shiur. So I gave this shiur because it was the first parak of Pirkei Avos. So I spoke about this Mishnah, and I mentioned this whole scenario, and someone in the shul came up to me, and he said, thank you for giving that shiur. You know, I didn't know anyone knew my ancestors. But I'm descended from both Akiva Schlesinger and Hillel Lichtenstein, and those are what my kids are named for, right? And I was like, yeah, I was like, I mean, look, I didn't, you know, he's not a kind of, he's a wonderful person, but still, he was happy to, you know, I mean, even if it's a particularly striking historical moment that I knew who they were. So just to summarize my thoughts, what you see is that this actually played out, where the sentiment behind the Maharil, right, that you should try to pretend things are more macho than they are to make sure that bad things don't happen, is what drove, right? That was basically what led to these sort of contorted arguments by the people who wrote the Pesach then. But then you have the Maram Shaker who said, look, I agree it's usher. But when something's usher on policy grounds, you should say it's usher on policy. It's a bad idea on policy grounds. You shouldn't pretend it's daraisa. That's usher because of altosif. Yeah, okay, questions, yeah, go. Oh, again, it was this most twisted argument in the world, right? It was like impossible to make this argument. Yeah, it's painfully argued. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. No, these are all midrashim.
They were all specifically living in a very isolated area.
Oh, yeah, yeah. All right. I mean, Ramosha has a tshuva where he argues that that's all true only when you don't have the Torah. Meaning, the reason it's so important to hold on to, like, cultural markers is when you don't have the Torah. But once you have the Torah, what defines us as law, so whatever. But at any rate, anyways. I mean, that's the Gemara's question, which is, hey, Chav Sivanu, when the Gemara says, second order, the Sivanu through the rabbis, right? What?
Same thing, yeah.
So, see, that's the interesting thing, is that the Rambam thinks that you are bound to listen to the rabbis because it's from the Torah. And he still thinks you can't pretend that it's first order biblical, rather than biblical in a generic sense, because you're supposed to listen to the rabbis, because he thinks that's exactly the point, is you're allowed, right, it's about pretending.
But
meaning,
what makes it like you're saying Gypsy Banu?
Well, I mean, see, that's the question. Is it really pretending when everybody knows, or are you telling me maybe everyone doesn't know, or doesn't really understand, right? Look, admittedly, that might be part of what drives the Maril and to some extent the Ravid, right? Which is, look, maybe not, right? The Rambam is assuming that everybody understands that Sivanu is really Dirabanan, right? When maybe it's not true. Maybe Maril will tell you what I mean. And the fact that most people don't understand this, I remember one of my teachers once telling me that, it took him a long time to understand his grandfather because he grew up on the Mishnah Berurah. And if you read Mr. Brewer, you know what's Daraisa, you know what's Darabanan, you know what's Minhag, you know what's this, right? You know the differences. His grandfather was like, people a few generations back, right? They don't, the Mishnah Brewer wasn't as popular yet. For a lot of simple Jews, a good from Balabatim, what was the book of choice? The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. And the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, you would read it, you would have no idea. No, for the average Balabat, what would they read? Yeah. They didn't read the Shulchan Aruch, it was too complicated, right? The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch was just like, Asr Mutter. But if you read the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, you'll have basically no idea whether something is Asr, Daraisa, Darabanan, Menus, or no. It is or it isn't Asr.
So the same issue generationally between
our parents and us, like, we had such higher... Correct. So, look, no, so I hear it. Meaning, I hear the Taina, which is that in a less educated world, anything like an asmachta or saying a sivanu might trick someone simply because they're not educated, right? I get that. I hear that. And that might be part of what convinced the Maharil that it can't be a problem,
yeah,
right?
It's not a problem if the problem's there. If it's not a problem there,
No, I understand. I'm not – it could be that that's the type of intuition that leads the – right? That's the type of intuition that leads the Maharil to think it can't be a problem. It could be, right? Meaning, it could be that the Rambam, look, I hear the Taina, to say that the Rambam is assuming a certain level of knowledge on behalf of the average person that maybe is unfair. And the Maril is saying the fact that the average person wouldn't know that is evidence that we don't care to blur the lines. I hear that. I don't think that's crazy, right?
You think in an ideal society where, like, everyone had halakhic knowledge?
Oh, good. So Ruthie's leading me to my next point, which is, okay, well, let's leave this aside. Now let's move to the next level, which is, let's talk about it in practical psak. Right now we've talked about the formal level, but let's talk about it a little bit pragmatically. So I'm not going to read through all of this, I put a lot here on, because when I first gave this year, right, that was when all these articles, first came up about partnership minyanim. And I noted that a lot of this seems to be at play in the way people treated partnership minyanim. Because certain poskim, like Rav Henkin, let's say, Rav Henkin thought that kriyat ha'torah by women is technically mutter, but a bad idea. So what did he write? He wrote, where does this all leave us? Regardless of the arguments that can be preferred to permit women's aliyah today, that kvodat tzibur can be waived, it does not apply when everyone is literate, that it does not apply when the olim rely on the male bakriya and do not themselves read, etc. Women's aliyot remain outside the consensus, and a congregation that institutes them is not orthodox in name, and it will not long remain orthodox in practice. In my judgment, this is an accurate statement now and for the foreseeable future, and I see no point in arguing about it. Now, I don't want to get into the local issue of partnership in Yanim. But regardless, what do you, right, remember, if Henkin thought technically, later post-game are not, there's no problem with, it's not baltosif to pretend that something's usher when it's really just a policy decision. However, Rav Henkin, in the continuation of his piece, argues that it's still a bad idea, right? Meaning, it may not be formally usher, but it's a bad idea. And you see that he himself, that's the way he poskens, right? Is that he thinks that women can get aliyot, but he thinks that it's a bad idea. So what does he say? I think it's mutter, but I think it's a bad idea, and that's my policy. Take it or leave it, right? Which is what he did. Now, on the other hand, Rav Schechter said not only is it usur, but it's diharig v'aliyavor, because it's motivated by feminism. Feminism is a movement that came from non-Jews, and therefore it's b'chukotam lo keleichu, and following the non-Jews, b'chukotam lo keleichu is a subsidiary of avodah zarah, and therefore partaking anything that resembles what a movement in the non-Jews is avodah zarah, and therefore it's yaharik v'yavor. Rav Yisachar Katz, right, among his critiques of Rav Schechter, again, I don't want to get into the details here, right? But one of the critiques, right, one of the critiques of Katz to him was, it's one thing to say that you disagree. It's another thing to basically blow up what might be, an Issur d'Rabbanan into the Yaharik v'aliyavor. But, okay, maybe I shouldn't even have brought the example. You can read it all inside. I left it there for you. But the reason that I think that Machoget was important was simply that, at least many people see that machloket as functioning in the same plane, right? Where you have people, some people understand Rav Schechter, I can't speak for whether Rav Schechter what he's doing or not, construing the most machner possible formulation because he thinks it's a bad idea, but he wants to take it in, in halakhic language. And there are those who say that's a great idea. There are those who say, I agree with you on policy, but I'm going to admit it's policy and not law. Right, Rav Henkin, and people who say, look, right, you can't do that. you know, I'm not, again, I can't get into his mind. I don't know whether, what he actually thinks. It's not my point here. But my point is that a lot of people think that these dynamics are at play in a lot of women's issues, especially, but a lot of hot button issues, where people have an intuition that people are being more machmir than they really mean. What they mean is it's a bad idea, and what they're saying is it's usur. And some people are okay with that, and some people are really not okay with that. But as Ruthie noted, I think what you need to do is, when you're moving from the halachic to the question whether it's a good idea, there are certain forces that push in both directions in the modern world. And they are very simply as follows. On the one hand, it's, you might say that there's more importance nowadays of being above board, because people are educated and A, can handle it, or B, in the past, they might not have checked your sources, right? In the past, if the rabbi said usur, people would just take his word for it. Nowadays, if you say something is usur in your heart of Yavor and people don't buy it, you're going to end up weakening yourself, because they're not going to buy it, and they're going to think you're just engaged in dishonest polemics. So on the one hand, there's more reason to believe that even if you think it's legitimate on a formal grounds to blur the line between law and policy, you shouldn't do it when people are, A, capable of understanding the distinctions because of their education level, or more cynically, are less likely to believe you when you engage in that type of polemic, and therefore your only hope at having people trust you and listen to you is being honest about what you're doing. Right? Meaning, if so, let's just imagine the scenario, right? Let's say someone goes to Rav Henkin and he says, I think partnership and yanim are mutter. And Rav Henkin says, I think you're right, but I think it's a bad idea, and that's my opinion. So what is someone supposed to say to them? I think it's a good idea. And he says, okay, but I think it's a bad idea. So, you know, like in the end of the day, being honest is sort of, right, it's basically said, it's policy. If you accept my authority or my assessment of what's going on in the community, great. If you don't, you don't. But what happens if someone says, I think it's Yehari Gval Yavor, and someone comes back and says, that's not a plausible halachic argument? So Rav Henkin could defend himself and say, look, I didn't say this was halacha. I said it was my personal opinion. You don't agree? Fine. So either you trust me or you don't. Right? The strength comes from the fact that you can't disprove it. The weakness comes from the fact that he's boiled it down to his policy position. On the other hand, saying something is usur when it's not, the strength is if they believe you, then they'll treat it as usur. The weakness is if they don't believe you, then what are they going to be left with? Nothing. Right? So in that sense, there's a benefit, I think, to, right, besides the halachic question, there's a pragmatic benefit to being honest about what's policy and what's not. There's a danger, though, which is the exact same forces push in the opposite direction, which is in a world where everyone is that educated and the laity is much more independent, right, both because of their education and because of the emphasis on autonomy and whatever, all the dynamics at play. You know, 100 years ago, maybe people had faith in their rabbi enough that if he said, I think it's mutter, but it's a bad idea, people might say, okay, I trust you. Nowadays, think about how many people say, well, Rav Henkin was a great posek, and Rav Henkin thought that it was technically mutter. And so therefore, I follow his halachic analysis. But I disagree with his assessment of the reality, that it's a bad idea. So I'm going to use all of his arguments in favor of partnership on him and now do exactly what he said not to, because he just said it was his policy. Right? Oh, for sure. But I'm just saying that practically, the danger, right, meaning part of the modern reality pushes in the direction of honesty, right? Because people are more educated, because they might be able to see through, right, dishonest argumentation. But it also pushes in the opposite direction, which is if you're too honest and you, right, meaning if you lay out why you think it's technically mutter, right? And then say, but I think it's a bad idea. So some people will listen, some people won't. So let's take the example of electricity for a second, right? If someone says, the Chazon Ish says it's also midaraita, so people might say, okay, I don't want to violate it, so daraita. But if you lay out all the arguments and say, I think probably it's not formally usur, but it'll really destroy the spirit of Shabbos, and people say, well, spirit of Shabbos, you know, I'm willing to buy 90% of what you said, that it's technically mutter, but spirit of Shabbos, or, right, you know, so there's the modern sort of connected, the reality of a very connected world with a very educated laity means that on the one hand, it's harder to pull off being dishonest about blurring the line between halakha and policy, but on the other hand, it might be the only way to get certain people to take you seriously, who might otherwise use your arguments, your formal arguments, lakula, against you. Right? Right? So there is this practical problem. Yeah, Ruthie. Correct. And then, very good. And this is why I wanted to do this when I think about writing. Because let's talk practical right now.
Yeah.
There's a middle ground between lying and not lying. Right? And that is, right, Ruby's right. I can be totally honest, but only when I write. Right? Meaning, I've been going through a few books, as you know, right, about different topics, and one of them, right, they said, you know, in the past, deception was often carried out by withholding information. Nowadays, it's much easier to deceive someone by giving them too much information, right? The easiest way to get someone to do something you don't want, right, they don't want to do, is to give them a 200-page, waiver form. Right, which, you know, with the box that just said, I've read and understood the terms of agreement and check it, right? They've given you so much information that you have no idea what you just signed on, right? If it was one paragraph that said everything that you were signing your life away for, right? So then you might actually know what you were signing. So Ruthie's right. You could come up with a modern middle way, which is, look, I will tell you the truth, but only in my 400-page Hebrew thing in a complicated Lishna Derabanan in Iraqi script. There I will give you all the kulot. But in my executive summary, I'll give you my bottom line, which is, I think this is a bad, I think you shouldn't do this. And I won't clarify more than that. I'm not lying, right?
This is funny. I think that's great.
But you understand that this is a middle ground. It's saying, I'm honest for anyone who I think can actually handle the nuance. But for people I'm worried or not, so I'll give you my executive summary and you'll miss the kulot, right? And again, I want you just to think about whether you think that's legitimate, right? Because as you think about writing, right, you have to think about whether, right, there's the two poles, right? Fudging the line and being totally honest, right? And then there's the middle, which is, if I write in Hebrew, I will go through all possible kulot. But my executive summary, either in Hebrew, l'sikum, or my English, will, right, or the way it is in many modern books, right? If you know who uses this to great effect? The English Shabbos book, the four-volume 39 Malachos, all the kulot are in Hebrew in the footnotes, and all the chumrot are in English in the front, right? It's all there, but the people who are educated enough to read the Hebrew, so the Hebrew footnote to an English Chumra, right, the Hebrew footnote Kula to an English Chumra is a way of being somewhere in between, right? That's also a model that people have, which clearly is not formally this problem, right? This is once you're negotiating the gray zone in the middle, right? Okay, let me just make one more point, and then I'll take the rest of the questions. We'll talk about it in the next 2 minutes. The one other thing that the rabbis primer note, and they have many pages on this, is obviously, even if you think that it's not baltosif, it could be ziyuf haTorah or bidvar sheker tirchak, right? Meaning, you do also have to deal with with, you know, the prohibitions on lying, where some folks can say it is, but others say, no, maybe it's even mutter to lie because you're preventing future violations of Jewish law. And this is under the rubric of things you're allowed to lie for. Just like you're allowed to lie for peace, you're allowed to lie for to protect the Torah. And they quote, which on the one hand, they quote Poskim like Rav Chaim David HaLevi, who say you're not allowed to lie because it's midvar sheker tirchak. And it'll, if you start lying to protect the Torah, as soon as your lie is discovered, it'll lead to a total loss in the trust in rabbinic authority. On the other hand, there are people like, they call it the Kliyakar, the Ta'omim, and others who say, no, it is it's permitted to lie if that's the only way to make sure that people don't violate Isurim. And I've given share on this in the past, whether you're really allowed to lie, it's a share for another time, but that is yet another factor to it. But like I said, when you're thinking about how to write halacha, this is very important. To both understand the formal question, is it baltosis to pretend and blur the line between d'oraita and not? But then there's the practical question, is it a good idea, especially in the modern world, which in certain senses pushed towards being less open, in certain senses pushed towards being more open, to blur the line between policy and law? And what are you comfortable with? And are you comfortable with all these middle zones of maybe putting kulot only in the footnotes in Hebrew, or right, or figuring out audience and figuring out who you're comfortable being extra explicit with the kulot, who you're going to not lie, but not, right, be too truthful, right, put it in the terms and agreements, right, essentially, right? Right, that's a middle zone, right? I don't think anyone can actually tell you putting it in the Hebrew footnote is dishonest, right? But they can say, but it's clearly a choice in terms of how you view what you're doing, right? And yeah, it may be, right? We all know that often that's the best way to make someone, right? The best way to be dishonest is to be very, very honest, right? To bore them to death, right? Right? You give them a one-page summary of why it's mutter, they'll go for it, right? If you give them a 200-page article to read and say, you know, and, you know, the kulot are buried in, you know, footnote 180, right? Yeah, you're being honest, but, right? You're also reaching for a certain result. That's also a move, right? Yeah. Okay, so this is the question, right? Is there are different types of policies, right? We've spoken mostly about policies that protect the Torah, right? So let's imagine Yaakov Ariel for a second. He thinks that using electricity all the time is actually the right of Shabbaton, right? So he thinks that we should treat individual acts of using electricity as forbidden, even if they might not technically be, to protect the Torah, right? That's like, right. So that's like a type of policy, right? That's definitely a policy argument, essentially, right? But it's a classic policy argument, right? It's protecting Torah law. Okay.
I think it's actually
completely
mutter, but it feels wrong.
Okay, right. So that's, you know, yet another complexity here, which is what type of policy do you mean? So I've been focusing on, because in Rabbi Yaakov Ariel's tshuva, in the case of electricity, if you want to say that that's what's going on, essentially some sort of policy argument, it's a very classic one. It's the slippery slope argument, which is, I really do think if you use electricity all the time, it would be d'oraita, and therefore I don't think you should use it ever, right? Agree or not, that's a very standard rabbinic policy argument, right? That's a slippery slope argument, right? You know, so when it comes to electricity, I think most of the arguments are more or less some sort of slippery slope argument, right? Not all of them, right? Some of them just think it's about the spirit of Shabbos, but it's not going to lead to d'oraita, which is maybe slightly different, right? Oh, you know, okay, before I answer your question, I will throw something out, which really I should spend more time on, but Rav Shurlo has an excellent article where he says, okay, but, you know, every slippery slope argument has a cost to it, because now you're saying that something which intrinsically is not problematic is problematic for the future. Right? So how do you make a calculus of when you can and can't make those decisions? So he very quickly sets up the following principles. He says, look, if you analyze the way rabbis make takanot, they take three factors into account, what he calls sikui, sikun, and mechir. One is, how bad would it be if the result actually happens? Right? The worse the result, the more machmir, right, the more guards you have to set up. Right? What's his proof for that? He said, because Chazal will say, you can only set up a gzera for a daraisa, but not for a derabana. Right? You don't do a gzera like gzera. But he said, part of that is because it's really bad if you violate the daraisa law, but if you violate the derabana law, it's not so bad. So we let you set up a protection on the biblical law, but not a protection on the protection. Because what's the worst option? You'll violate the rabbinic law. Big deal. Right? But he said, on the other hand, we allow you to set up zera l'gzera b'makom karet. Right? If the daraisa in question is karet, we allow you to send a second order gzera. The second factor he says you have to take into account is sikui. How likely is it that if you don't set up a policy problem, the result will actually happen? Right? And this he derives from rabbinic principles like milta zol shchicha l'gazer b'rabbana. Right? That rabbis don't set up takanot for things that are uncommon. Right? He says, what you see is that Chazal only do it if, right, it's likely. If once in a while it would lead to a bad result, that's not enough to stop people from doing something which is fundamentally mutter. And the third factor, he says, is mechir, which is, what's the cost to the people who want to engage in the not problematic act? Right? What's the cost to them? Right? Because, and he says, you see this in Chazal, because Chazal say, Makom hesed lo gazer rabbanan, right? That when there's extreme loss, we don't set up takana, which shows you that even though we really do think there's a danger that you might violate the law, we don't set up safeguards if the safeguards are overburdensome. Right? So he thinks that when you're setting up policy decisions, you need to take those three factors into account. Okay, going back to your question, yeah. So anything that's of the more or less the slippery slope argument, at least I understand that policy, because that is classic rabbinic policy, right? That's called a takana, right? That's called a siyah. But yes, a repentant type argument, which is the people who go to partnership minyanim are outside of the Orthodox mainstream, and the only people who engage in that are outside the Orthodox mainstream, and it's dangerous to be part of that type of community, and therefore I'm going to forbid it, right? That's a very, right, what type of weight does that have? So that's a hard question. If you say it is policy, so then if you leave it at the level of policy, then you leave it at the level of policy, right? Meaning, when Repentian said that, he said it at the level of policy. He said, I don't think this is a good idea. Take it or leave it. I don't think it's a good idea. Right? What weight is that? Well, there are clearly halachic values that point in the direction of being part of the community of people who are committed to Torah, right? That's helpful, that's important sociologically, that's important religiously, right? That clearly is valuable, but he's not claiming it's halacha. But you're right. Rav Schechter's argument is essentially policy in halacha, which is being involved with a movement which has, which gets its roots in the secular world might be intrinsically problematic, right, on halachic grounds. You've got to take each argument for its own, right, because different policies are more or less, right, if someone said, well, I'm worried it's going to splinter the community. So there is a value in halacha called lotus go to do. There's a formal lotus go to do, right, the formal limitations of factionalism. But you might say that once there's the formal limitations, there's also room to talk about not formal limitations, right? Like, what might be a bad idea because it'll lead to factionalism or fighting, which is something we care about, right? But maybe this doesn't fit the formal prohibition, right? I think the answer is you need to figure out each policy and figure out, what Torah values is it being inspired by, if not dictated by. Right? And it's going to depend. Right? And again, it's going to depend on whether you're comfortable leaving at the level of policy. Right? If someone just says, look, I think it's a bad idea because whatever, I don't know, I think you shouldn't have you know, very expensive weddings because it will lead poor people to extend themselves beyond, right, their means, right, which Hasidus Rebbes have said. What's the value there? He's not saying it's usher. He's saying, like, the Torah cares about poor people, and the Torah is clearly not that materialistic, and you're setting up a materialistic culture which is hurting poor people, even if not directly, right? Is it usher? No. But are the values being articulated there, you know, emergent from Torah? I mean, arguably, yes. I don't think it's crazy, right? So I think you have to take each policy and figure it out for itself. And I think, look, as we, you know, now, you know, as you think about writing, you may need to figure that out, which is if you think it's a policy, so you got to figure out, okay, even I think it's usher on policy grounds, or I think it should be, not usher, I think it should be problematic on policy grounds, well, what drives my intuition that this should be the policy, right? And then if you think that it's halakhically inspired but not mandated, so then you might want to articulate that and figure out how to articulate that yourself, right? I think that's a plausible thing, but, you know, and this is where things get murky, and then you got to figure out how honest you want to be, right? And not necessarily do you want to be dishonest, but maybe you just don't want to be open. Maybe you don't want to write about it. Maybe you let those motivations float around in your head, and then, but you don't write it down on paper because you don't think it'll resonate with people, right? Well, those are all options, right? So this, I hope, gets you in that mindset of the problems of, again, of actually writing, right? Which is, right, how you write and how honest you are and what you hide and what you don't hide and how explicit you are, what language you write in. Remember, we talked about at the beginning of the year, that's really important, both on formal grounds, if you think that it's legitimate to actually lie, right, but even just on pragmatic grounds, if you don't think that. Okay, I know now it's supposed to be mincha time, right? So, like, or it was supposed to be mincha time, and I'm way over. Okay, fine, I'll just stop. What? Yeah, that happens.